Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I've never discussed the American Civil War in any of my videos or audios, though it is a topic that I've had a look at. I don't claim to be an expert, but there are a couple of things that struck me as very interesting. And I'm actually a big fan of Robert E. Lee. General Robert E. Lee. There are things about Robert E. Lee that I like a lot. I really think that he's not given as much credit as he should be for being a truly excellent commander. He is probably the most interesting American that I've looked at from a military point of view. Even though I've never put out anything on my videos, and he's actually a fascinating topic for discussion. And do you know that there were people who said in the military that Robert E. Lee would never amount to much as a high-level commander, and yet he proved them all wrong, and it shows how little they understood about this man's talents. But anyway, today we're not going to discuss Robert E. Lee. I had another friend tell me that the Confederacy, the American South, was going to be the world's first whites-only ethno-state. And the guy who told it to me is a Yankee. He said I can tell people he's a Yankee. But I respect him, even though he's a Yankee. I respect him because he has certain knowledge. But then I decided to talk to a Southerner, to Frederick Blackburn of Blackbird 9 Trading Posts. And he pointed me to a three-part series that he did on the American Civil War. So this is the first of that three-part series because I'm listening to it, because I'm trying to get up to speed on some of his research. So I thought you'd also find this interesting. So this is part one.
You know, February is very important that we use this to tell the real history of black history, not the kosher sanitized version. So, you're listening to Blackbird 9's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. Glad everyone can join us tonight. If you'd like to come out and join us in the chat room, you can go to blackbird9sbreakfastclub.org and hit on the menu and come into the podcast lounge. And from there, you can go into the chat room, or you can go straight into the Chatango chat room at bb9tradingpost.chatango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chatango.com. And tonight we want to look at the U.S. Uncivil War. And I kind of did a play on words with the title. This is episode 60, and I left the periods out to say the US Uncivil War. And the point I was trying to make is that when we look at the US war between the states, war of northern aggression, the trickery of masonry, etc., and bankers, the result has always been the same, that we have been tricked by these Jewish people and these Jewish bankers into fighting wars that do nothing but kill the best of the best of the European people. And when you read the Talmud, you see that that is part of the Talmudic thought of the best Gentiles must die so they don't pose a threat. And that's one of the problems the Jews have always had with the Europeans, is we are a legitimate threat. And so they see us as an abomination, especially under Noahide law. And so here we had this event in our history, you know, we had only been this great experiment constitutional republic for a very short period of time, and suddenly you have states going to war against states in what may be, you know, one of the bloodiest battles in modern history. Because, yeah, this was like the one of the first modern wars. And also one of the first wars that was recorded with the new media of the photograph. The camera obscura was invented, you know, right before this war. So we actually have these photographic records of the years leading up to this war and the horrors of this war, and then the carnage that was left over after the wars, and, you know, just how bad it was after. And that's one of the things of war. They always promise you that after the war, everything's going to be better, but that's not the case. And, yeah. And that's the other thing is, you know, like George 1951 says, you know, all the correspondence and orders from both sides that survived the war. You always look, you know, who were the people who died in the war and who were the people who never die in wars? And those are the people ordering everybody else out to fight. So, yeah, that's where, you know, you get into the banker systems, that these, you know, shadow banking systems are the ones that are creating the pressure cookers that these wars are germinated in. So, like many people, you know, I was trained on the Civil War, and you look at the my public education, we were taught that the Civil War was fought to end slavery, period. That was the reason for the Civil War, was to end slavery. And Abraham Lincoln was a saint because he freed the slaves. And the North was right and the South was wrong. And the Southerners are just white supremacist, racist slave owners that deserve to basically perish for their role in slavery. And there was an article this week about yet another Confederate statue being removed at taxpayer expense, and I think it's going to cost, I have to look it up, but it's like several thousand, like tens of thousands, if not more, dollars that it's going to take to remove this statue that has been there for a very long time in Charlottesville, Virginia, of General Lee. And, of course, this is the George Soros-type cultural Marxists that are demanding this statue be removed. And I go back to Rabbi Manus Friedman's comment about the only way to fight a moral war is the Jewish way. Destroy their temples, kill men, women, children, and cattle. And we see that again and again and again with the Jewish war model. It's all about destroying a culture's identity so they lose their sense of who they are. A demoralized people have no resistance. You can't organize them. You can't unify them because they have nothing to fight for. They have been demoralized. And so this is just another shaming tactic against white people, especially white males, and the so-called patriarchy. And it's just a symbol of, you know, Western civilization, that, you know, you look at the reality of the Southern states and who had the slaves, and you'll find that it was not the Christian families. It was mainly the Jewish families that had slaves, had the slave plantation, ran the slave markets, ran the slave ships, ran the slave capture operations. And so the only reason we're given this idea of Southern Christian men were slave owners is from the Jewish media in Hollywood, especially. Another one of those key things to teach you the Civil War, and I put this novel, this fictional novel, in the same category as The Scarlet Letter. You have these very emotionally charged scenes to teach children about a time period that are completely made up. The Scarlet Letter had no basis in reality, but yet that is taught to school children to explain both the Pilgrim movement and the Puritan movement. And the novel that they feed children is The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane. And this was a book that he did. It's a very thin book. And it was one of the first books he wrote. It was picked up. It was done originally in sections in newspapers and magazines and such. And it has not been out of print since it was released. And so that tells you that they are really pushing this. And The Red Badge of Courage, it's a fictional work. And there is so much demoralization in that novel, especially towards the Southern armies, but just, in general of this, so-called coming-of-age novel of the young soldier in the Union Army who finally realizes what it is he's fighting for. And again, it goes into this idea of, to end slavery. And so that's, one of the big ones they hit children with is The Red Badge of Courage. And so, just to go back through what I was saying in Saturday shows, you've got to realize that the Jews are completely bankrupt with their belief system. That, 70 AD, the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem. And I keep harping on this because I really want you to understand that that war never ended. They see all white people as Rome, and they consider themselves the new Maccabees that are going to bring in this new world order. And so, again, you had the diaspora at 70 AD, 740, the Jews thrown out of Constantinople by Leo III, went to the Khazaria, King Bulan and the nobles converted to Judaism. This is the birth of the Jewish Ashkenazi Jew, who then, came through in the Norman invasion of England in 1066. In 1070, they had established in England 1100, 1099, you see the Priory of Zion formed. 1100, you start seeing the hexagram showing up in Jewish good luck charms. We go all through this, and it's the same thing. You have Europeans trying to set up the law of the land that's to benefit the people, and at the same time, you have this predatory Jewish class that's hooked up internationally that is trying to take control of everything, especially the banking, to turn all the Europeans into slaves and eventually breed them out of existence. So as we go through, the same story from... how many times did the Jews get thrown out for doing this thing? 109 countries, 200 times in the last 2,000 years. And so we've talked about, trying to set up laws with like things like the Magna Carta to establish rules on the Jews, and it just wouldn't work until, so in 1215 you had the Magna Carta, 1290 the Jews were expelled from England. And like we were talking about, in the show that, they got thrown out of England in 1290, 1306 from France, 1307, all the Knights Templars were rounded up in France, 1492, they're expelled from Spain, And then the big shatter to that geocentric Jewish model was, when Copernicus challenged their geocentric worldview in 1530, and then in 1781, when William Herschel discovered the eighth planet, that completely destroyed the traditional Jewish system of that menorah-based, the seven free-willed planets. Well, suddenly, that's all exposed as being nonsense. So you've got a completely bankrupt system in Jewry, but you've got a very, heavily financed, wealthy, organized system that has no identity themselves. And I think that's part of why they always go after white European identity, is because they know that their own system is so bankrupt. And that's part of that, anger. Well, our systems are all based in historical fact. We have our legends and such, but, our history is sound. And there's a meme going on today that may be my favorite meme, which basically says Israel has no history, just a criminal record. And that is so true because, the system is bankrupt, and that's why they have basically bound it together for this last-ditch effort of world Zionism. And as we go through this three-part series on the Civil War, what I want to show you is that that was just another stepping stone in their, what we call the Greater Israel Project for their New World Order. And so trying to get people to see the long game of Judaism is really hard because, they just, most people don't think in those kind of terms, but, the Jews have. And I think this is part of the reason is, they still blame Rome for losing Jerusalem, but they can't admit that their system is bankrupt. And so it's just this revenge-oriented mentality, and that revenge that the ends justify the means runs throughout all of this history of, the Jews coming in, with the sob story, oh, let us in, we've got money, we can be helpful. And as soon as they establish themselves, they start enslaving everybody with all their dirty tricks. And they start doing all their Talmudic religion practices, like, sex with children, prostitution. You read the Talmud, you realize how base and, debauched this system really is. And so when it gets discovered, they get thrown out and they go someplace else and they play the eternal victim and say, oh, those horrible bad people, they threw us out. And then, people take them in and the cycle just continues. So, here, the beginnings of the Civil War are being formed when they finally got back into England and established the Bank of England. So in 1694, they established the Bank of England. They got back in 1656. And it was about that time period where you started seeing people warning people about Freemasonry. So in 1698, you see the first anti-Masonic pamphlets circulating around in England because you're starting to see the Jews get established and they're recruiting the best of the best of the Goy, the good Goy, and that is the foundation of Freemasonry. And by 1717, the Grand Lodge of England is established. Now, that is a key point because what many people don't understand about U.S. history is that all the Freemason lodges in the United States that are authorized don't have their charter with some lodge that may be in, say, Philadelphia or even South Carolina. They have a charter with the Grand Lodge of England. So this tells you that there has always been a lot more going on behind the scenes with these wars, like the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, on, you know, you just keep going, because you had these people in these Masonic circles that were based out of the Grand Lodge of England. And so all the Freemasonry is based in the Grand Lodge of England. So the first official lodge in North Carolina was in 1717, which was St. John's. In 1737, there was a Luciferian group called the Order of the Palladium that was established in Paris. Now, this is going to be very significant, because we see that the Order of the Palladium would grow into this organization that would morph with Freemasonry, and we'll see people like Isaac Long and Albert Pike showing up in that system later on, right before the Civil War starts. So, think, 1737, the Order of the Palladium is established. Then the other thing is, we're looking at the Freemasons, and then we're looking at the bankers that were involved in the Civil War. So 1743 is when Meir Amschel Bauer, an Ashkenazi Jew, was born in Germany. And so he then apprenticed for the Oppenheimers for 10 years in Hanover, Germany, and learned basically the trade of money creation, those Talmudic tricks of not only fractional reserve banking, but also usury, interest and compound interest, and basically, loan sharking, and figuring out that it's more profitable to loan to governments than it is to loan to people. And we've talked repeatedly in the show about how that model of the Jewish model of money, which defines money as debt, and then you say that you're going to charge interest on money. So the second that money is created with interest, there is more debt than money in the supply to pay for it. It's a loser's game. It's always going to crash. And so this is the foundation of when Amschel Bauer was learning all this, and would then in 1760, he would change his name to Rothschild or Redshield and adopt that six-pointed hexagram star as his totem or his symbol, his icon. And we see that that symbol has nothing to do with Judaism. But we started seeing this first around the 1200s as good luck charms. And these Ashkenazi Jews coming across, they would use it as good luck charms. And then it just kept getting incorporated into this Jewish system. And for example, the Rothschilds, and would later be adopted by the first Zionist Congress and also the flag of Israel. So they knew that the old system, the menorah system, was busted. So they're trying to reinvent themselves as this master race that is going to be their own gods. And that's the key thing, is they just think of themselves as these uber people that are above everyone else, and everyone else should be their slaves. And it doesn't matter that their entire system is flawed and bankrupt. They, as a people, consider themselves superior. And that's the mindset you're dealing with here. Now, when we talk about how the Revolutionary War got started, it's interesting that the, despite what they tell you in public school, when the Bank of England was questioning how come the American colonies had become so prosperous in such a short period of time, Ben Franklin made the comment that it's because we have our own currency, colonial script. And this, of course, completely freaked out all the Jewish bankers at the Bank of England to think that these goyim were printing their own money that, you know, weren't paying the tribute that they were supposed to be paying according to Talmudic law for the use of that money. So it was, this is outside the system. We can't have that. So immediately the Bank of England made the English Parliament pass the Currency Act of 1764, and this was signed by King George III, and that prohibited the colonies from using their colonial script anymore. And so you immediately had this huge crash in the colonies. Franklin went on to say that, that was the main reason for the Revolutionary War. And one of the first things that was in the Constitution was that we will print our own money. Well, we've seen that change over 8 times in the history of this Constitutional Republic. So many times we see that this war or that war was fought over this Jewish central bank. The Jewish central bank, like the Federal Reserve and all the different variations before it, came out of this Bank of England type system. And we've always been trying to get away from it. And unfortunately, since 1913, we have been slaves to it again. Another key thing that we have to understand is this thread that was developing that would come into play during the Civil War with Wyshop. He was contracted by Mayor Amschel Rothschild to draw up plans for a uber secret society called the Illuminati or the Keepers of the Light. And they came up with the Order of the Perfectibilists, and their goals were basically to abolish Christianity and all civil government so it could be replaced with their New World Order. So, that was May 1776. So that was the foundation of that Illuminati. Now, a lot of people say, that's just old conspiracy theory. That didn't really happen. Well, in 1786, a courier, one of Rothschild's couriers, was randomly struck by lightning, and in his satchel they found these documents, and it was, as damning as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion at the time. And the Bavarian government sent them out, as a warning to all the other governments that, there is this group that is trying to infiltrate all these systems to bring in the downfall of Christianity and the rise of this New World Order. So that was happening in, this lead up to the Civil War. So, Snippets is talking about Judah Benjamin. We will talk at length about him in next week's show because this, remember, tonight's we're just looking at all the threads where they got started that kind of came to a head, if you will, during the Civil War. And then next week we're going to talk about the actual mechanics of the Civil War. But I'm trying to give you an idea of, this is part of a long game strategy, and it's, to do with Jewish bankers, secret societies that are Masonic based, be there, Knight Templar, Freemasonry, the Illuminati, etc. All of these are based on the same game theory models, and they're all being controlled by these Jewish Kabbalists and such, like, the Rothschilds. So, Now, at the same time this is happening, you know, so 1789, you know, give you a benchmark, you know, that the U.S. Constitution is ratified in 1789. So, you know, 3 years after the Bavarian government sent out this warning, the U.S. Constitution is ratified. 1791, the Bill of Rights is ratified. Now, that is definitely a slap in the face to the Talmudic Noahide law people, because under Talmudic Noahide law, non-Jews have no rights. You have only privileges that can be granted or taken away by the whim of the master. And this is that carrot and stick, and they stay at the master class. And, you know, so that, you know, we uppity goyim, you know, put out there that we had inalienable rights, was definitely a pushback against this Talmudic systems. So, this idea of, you know, the revolutions being going on all around the world, you know, you start to see the pattern of where did all these revolutions start? Were there Jewish populations there? Were they involved? And the answer time and time again is yes. It's just like George Soros today. We had the same type of instigators working in the shadows back then. So 1793, when King Louis the 16th was executed by the revolutionaries, that sent shocks throughout the world that, you know, they were bold enough to be killing off the royalty. And this really affected Catherine II of Russia, because she was, you know, very progressive, if you will, trying to modernize Russia and bring Russia into the modern nation. She really thought that the West was on the right path. But then when the, you know, the French Revolution, you know, became a purge, you know, she really had to start second guessing this. And this sort of estranged her with the Jewish population of Russia, which then we saw how that played out. So that's where you started seeing a rift between the royal family, the Romanovs in Russia, and the Jewish globalists. And, you know, also the role, we'll see the role of Russia in the United States during the Civil War, as well as, you know, what role did France play? What role did England play? What role did Spain play? So, you know, this is where, you know, Catherine the Second really started questioning all of this revolutionary thought and thought it was going in the wrong direction. She was absolutely right. 1794, the French abolished slavery, but Napoleon instigated it back in 1802, and then the French did away with slavery for good in 1848. So, again, you know, this is one of those things that we need to express during Black History Month, is that the Jews have always had slavery. It's, you know, because Judaism is a master-slave system. It was the Europeans that were pushing against slavery and fighting these old systems and the old Jewish slave running systems, etc. And so that is one of the key things that we have to keep, you know, hammering in to the blacks and the Mexicans, etc., is that no, the Europeans were outlawing slavery. We were moving away from slavery. And so we start seeing, you know, the European countries abolishing slavery one after another, but, you know, starting with France in 1794. Then, you know, in 1800 is when the Napoleonic Wars began. So all through, you know, this period where the new Constitutional Republic is just getting off its feet. Thomas Jefferson, for example, he was the third president sworn in 1801. You know, that was at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, okay? And we know how once Napoleon lost, how Rothschild was able to basically buy up all of England through his deception of the markets. So that, you know, is what gave him the capital then to launch his international campaigns and we'll see how much financing the Rothschilds played in the U.S. Civil War. Okay. Then the War of 1812 comes along, and the U.S. goes to war with Great Britain again. And one of the things that's very peculiar about that war is, you know, we say we won the War of 1812, but yet we ended up with a Jewish central bank. And so that really tells you, you know, who really won the war. And it was a big battle to get that central bank removed. And that's when, you know, Andrew Jackson came into play later on to run them out. But, you know, the War of 1812, once again, the U.S. gets a Jewish private central bank. Now, in 1817, we had a power shift in the Freemasonry lodges. Up until that time, you basically had two threads of lodges. You had the modern Freemasons and the ancient Freemasons. The modern Masons supported the crown and the Bank of England. The ancient Freemasons supported the colonies and the great experiment of, you know, the Constitutional Republic. In 1817, basically the ancients stepped down and merged with the moderns, forming the free and accepted modern Masons as it is known today. You know, so in 1817, you had this big merge in the Freemasons, and it's basically, you know, a consolidation of Masonic thought, all of them having charter with the Grand Lodge of England. Now, 1819, Florida, which had been a Spanish territory, was acquired by treaty. So now we have, in part of the Republic, is that area of Florida. This sets up, you know, the beginning of the great expansion of the United States. And so very rapidly we see the 13 original colonies growing to cover basically that whole section of North America as we know it today. But this all happened very, very quickly, starting with, like I said, you know, Florida in 1819. In 1823 is when we had the Monroe Doctrine. And that was James Monroe, the American continents are not subject to European colonization anymore. Now, many people think that it was his vice president, John Quincy Adams, who actually penned the Monroe Doctrine. But this was key as far as setting up a game rule with the old world, saying you can't do any more colonization here. And this also flew in the face of those Jewish plantation owners, because so much of the slavery was happening in the Caribbean and in South America. And so when you look at, you know, history, they always, you know, talk about the U.S. slave trade, but by when you compare it, it's very small compared to the amount of slave trade going on in South America and in the islands. So the Monroe Doctrine was that line in the sand saying you can't set up any more colonization from Europe on the in the New World. Now, meanwhile, in 1825, back over in Russia under Nicholas I, you had the Decembrist Rebellion. So again, this was the Jews agitating there for an overthrow, just like they were doing in France. And Nicholas fires on the Decembrists, and that became the bloody shirt that the Bolsheviks would use for the rest of the time to carry out the Red Terror throughout Russia. As, you know, remember the Decembrist Rebellion. And so that, you know, again, is showing the big picture of how, you know, the Jews were trying to take down all the nations. Okay. So in 1826, a big anti-Masonic sentiment started in the United States after the disappearance of Captain William Morgan. Now, William Morgan had written a book that was published after his death called Illustrations of Freemasonry, and he basically went through all the Masonic rituals of the first, second, and third degrees to show there's no truth in these systems and trying to explain what they were and expose them. And he was disappeared and, you know, assumed murder, and that created a big anti-Freemason movement, and people started really questioning who these Freemasons were, and are they, you know, good for the country, or are they traitors? And so in 1831, it got so bad that William Wirt and Amos Ellmarker run for president of the U.S. And vice president on the anti-Masonic ticket. So they were really trying to push the Freemasons out. Now, another thread that starts developing at this time that comes into play is the rise of Mormonism. So in 1827, Joseph Smith, you know, is said to receive the golden plates and the translation stones to write the Book of Mormon. And 1830, the Book of Mormon is published. So this was a huge development in the Great Experiment. Suddenly you had this new movement. They called themselves the Latter-day Saints, the Good Doers. And it was this huge movement that developed very, very quickly. But many people think that it was a very synthetic movement that was, again, funded by Jewish bankers as a way to divide the great experiment of the United States. And it had that effect. There was a huge schism between especially the Protestants and the Mormons, to the point where in 1844, Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram Smith were lynched by a mob that broke into the jail and dragged them out and lynched them in Carthage, Illinois, after Smith had announced that he was going to run for president. This had such a backlash that the Mormons went into exile over 1,000 miles away in Salt Lake City, Utah. And so, yeah, that was just another factor that was going on, is this development of Mormonism. And to me, it's very similar to how we saw the rise of the Scofield Bible later on in the 1900s. So, you know, that this Mormon phenomenon, you know, was probably very synthetic, and it probably had a lot more Jewish influence than we see, or we think, especially when you start analyzing Mormonism. You see a lot of Kabbalistic, Talmudic symbolism involved. So, you know, I kind of see it as the same model as these other Masonic systems. It's basically a system to create a hierarchy of Gentiles that can then be controlled by controlling its leadership. So I hope I haven't offended any Mormons in the audience, but, you know, they're, you know, these movements, you know, you always got to wonder where they came from, especially when they grow that quickly. We talked about the Boy Scouts last week, you know, that the Boy Scouts grew to the numbers it did in so few years shows you that it was a very synthetic movement. People were pushing it, people with lots of power and money. And same thing with Mormonism. It was, you know, definitely well promoted. Let's just leave it at that. So now, another thing that is very suspect is in 1831, the same kind of time frame as when the Book of Mormon and stuff is just coming out, it's this idea of trying to divide and conquer, is Nat Turner led a slave revolt in Virginia and killed 50 white people, and that became a huge sensation that just really set race relations on edge. So you think, okay, we're about 30 years from the outbreak of the Civil War, and we have this, you know, so-called slave revolt in Virginia that ended up with a lot of white people being murdered. That had a huge effect on the psyche of the white Americans, and also on about, you know, the slavery movement and the anti-slavery movement, I said. Now, another bit of this puzzle is, you know, we saw how Florida was part of Spain. Then we look over at all the territory that Mexico had, and we see the development of this new republic called the Republic of Texas. So in 1836, Sam Houston is sworn in as the president of the Republic of Texas, and he was also the Grand Master of the Grand Masonic Lodge of Texas. So the entire Republic of Texas project, it was a Freemason project from beginning to end, all the way down to the Lone Star flag, that it was, you know, the Masonic star, that five-pointed star, you know, that's all Masonic based. And all of those top people who made the Republic of Texas a reality were all high-ranking Freemasons. Now, and just, you know, again, just a little data dot to keep you in context with your timeline is in 1837, the same time that, you know, this new Republic of Texas is being created, Queen Victoria was crowned Queen of England when she was 18. So here we have Queen Victoria in 1837 becoming Queen of England. And the, like I said, you know, one of the big developments right then at that time was, you know, 1839 was when the William Wollaston invented the camera obscura, or the camera, the foot, you know, and suddenly we have photographic records. So for the first time, you know, you're able to see pictures of all these people rather than just reading newspaper articles about them. And so that was a huge development in technology and our ability to, you know, have a historical record. And that's why, you know, the Civil War was one of those first wars that had a photographic record, and you could actually see the carnage and the suffering of that war and, you know, what those soldiers endured fighting. Now, in 1844, as part of a backlash of the Nat Turner massacre, was the development of an anti-slavery Liberty Party. Now, this is a tactic we've seen again and again and again in this republic, where any time they had an agenda and it looked like they were going to lose the presidential vote because the will of the people was against their agenda, you would see them create a third party run. And so, the, you know, we talked about this in an earlier show about how Wilson, you know, Woodrow Wilson got into the office after the party ticket was split with, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Party. So, you know, those kind of things. So here, this Liberty Party that was had its foundation as anti-slavery split the ticket, and so their candidate James Birney allowed the Democrat James Polk to defeat the Whig Party candidate Henry Clay, who was, you know, he was basically the shoo-in, but because of the split ticket over this emotionally charged issue of slavery, James Polk was able to get into office. 1 year later, President James Polk annexed the Republic of Texas into the United States. 1 year after that, the U.S. goes to war with Mexico. So here, you know, you had the Masonic project of the Republic of Texas basically taking that land and creating a republic that is then annexed into the United States. and then we go to war with Mexico. That just kind of seems pretty laid out and planned when you look at it. What was the agenda? What are we trying to accomplish here? That was a two-year war, and in 1848, Mexico loses, and the areas that would become California, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Colorado, and western Texas were then granted to the United States. Meanwhile, lands that would become, in 1846, lands that would become Washington, Oregon, Idaho, were acquired by treaty with Great Britain. So Great Britain basically made a deal with us to give those areas. So you have now that whole northwest, Washington, Oregon area, that's now part of the United States. So there's just massive amount of, land grab throughout North America during this very short period of time. Now, to give you a view of another, data dot, 1847, Karl Marx and Frederick Engels formed the Communist League in London. And then in 1848, Karl Marx releases the Communist Manifesto. So here you're seeing this communist model coming out of the same people who are financing the Freemasons. So, Engels and Marx, were definitely part of that communist group that was being funded by the Jewish banks, especially the Rothschilds, that would then funnel money into Russia to finance the Bolshevik Revolution. They were funding money down to the Ukraine for the Holodomor. Then they were funneling money down into Turkey for the Young Turks Domey revolutions that would happen later at the turn of the century. But, this is where it was starting with, Marx and Engels and the Communist League in London, and then the Communist Manifesto coming out. Then you have the random elements of history that just kind of popped in there. In 1848, there was a huge gold strike at Sutter's Mill in California. And that was one of the big disappointments of the move into North America by England and the colonies, because, the Spanish, much earlier had gone into Central America and those areas and found all the gold. And, that gave rise to the great, Renaissance periods there, all that, gold coming from the New World to finance the church, etc. Well, all these countries like England, sent their explorers hoping to find gold, and you never really found any. Until 1848, there was a small strike in North Carolina and Georgia. A few years earlier, but when the Sutter's Mill strike happened, that was huge, because up until that point, basically gold was the possession of kings and royalty. And so you have this idea of anybody could go stake a claim and mine gold and have gold. And so that was a huge development at very many levels, both financial, what's it going to do to the gold market, but just the philosophical, that you can't have lay people having gold. That's just not the way things are in the world. We have an order for these things. So the Sutter Mill, strike was huge. Now, another thing that, really defined the Civil War was the development of the railroads throughout the United States. And so, that was a big part of the war machine, and also war targets, targeting the trains. That was the supply lines. A lot of the battles, took place to control those railroads and the railroad lines. and the, you know, the trains and the railroad lines. But it's interesting that the first railroad bridge that was built across the Mississippi River was in 1850. And this set off a big turf war between the riverboat companies and the railroad companies, because up until that point, you know, the railroad companies were limited of how far they could go, because you just couldn't get a steam engine and a train across a river because you couldn't build a bridge strong enough. Suddenly, with modern metalworking technologies and modern engineering design, you could build a structural bridge that could support the weight of a locomotive and its cargo cars and go across rivers. And so that set off a huge land or a turf war between the riverboat industry and the train industries. And it's interesting that a young Abraham Lincoln, who was fresh out of law school or whatever, the young lawyer, represented the railroad companies in this, and that's sort of how he got his start and established himself as defending the railroads in their push westward and their control over territories. And you know, one of the things about the railroads was how much right of way they were granted. It was just an outrageous amount of land that they were given as part of their incentive to build their railroads into the new frontier. Now, it was at this time, about 1850, that also the Freemasons, which have always been, you know, boys only. That's one of the things, sort of like these Jewish systems that, you know, those, they'll have, you know, they'll put a female rabbi out there every now and then. But when you look at the real power systems in Judaism, it's always male. And, you know, Freemasons were always male. Knight Templars were always male. So one of the things that was interesting is in 1850 was that they tried to, they introduced the Order of the Eastern Star as an organization for women. And it was very successful. And by 1983, you know, the ranks of Eastern Star women has grown to over 2 million members. So this is another one of those organizations that, you know, got established and grew very, very rapidly. And so you wonder, you know, how organic was it? How synthetic was it? Then in 1853, you know, the Gadsden Purchase, that basically gave the rest of the land that became Arizona and New Mexico to the United States. Then it was 1854 and 1856 that the Republican Party is formed. And we know that, you know, Abraham Lincoln became one of the poster children for the Republican Party. And they would, you know, go on to have a great role during the war and after the war. Now, another little cultural development with this, you know, we're in the industrial age of science, and that included chemistry and trying to create these medicines. And in 1855, Frederick Gadiac isolated the active ingredient of the cocoa plant, and he named it erythroxylene, I think, erythroxylene. But anyway, that would lay the foundation for Albert Niemann later in 1860 to isolate the alkaloid of cocaine. And when you look at the influence that cocaine had on all of those main thinkers of the world Zionist movement, be it Freud, Marx, you know, all of these guys just were heavily into this new drug of cocaine. And if you've ever studied people who become addicted to cocaine, you can see the personality changes, et cetera, that manifested in these very powerful men, these supermen of this time. You know, because remember, they were trying to build, you know, the Ubermen, and they just thought they were the master race. And cocaine helped to fuel all of that, and, you know, that they were going to conquer the world. And so, you know, this was perfectly legal, and it was one of those, you know, upper echelon circle drugs. So, you know, the cocaine industry, you know, really got its start at the same time as all of this, you know, great globalism was happening, and it really fueled a lot of these, you know, Marxist thinkers. And so, also just, you know, 1859, you know, Darwin publishes Origin of Species. Again, we're trying to get into this idea of, you know, evolution and the fittest shall survive to justify these very brutal Marxist philosophies. So that was happening. And then 1859 also, Albert Pike becomes the Grand Commander of North American Freemasonry and holds this position until his death in 1891. And when we get to next week's show, we're going to see how Albert Pike really was one of the designers of the actual Civil War and what happened after the Civil War. And so he's, and, you know, this post-Civil War Freemasonry system that they rolled out that then we saw manifest in the revolutions of, you know, in Russia, et cetera, the Bolshevik Revolution, the beginning of communism. And this was all having its genesis there right in the lead up to the Civil War. Another, we talked about the gold strike in 59. You also had the Comstock silver mine in Virginia City, Nevada. And that was a game changer because huge fortunes were made overnight in the Comstock mine. And this was the basis of the Hearst money. Then in 1859, also, people were, you know, really questioning where the Republic was going. And John Stuart Mill published his great book on, it's called On Liberty. Now, munitions going in, we'll talk more about this next week, but, you know, one of the things in 1860, Henry Rifles released the Henry 1860-15 self-contained cartridge repeating rifle, which was one of the first semi-automatic rifles developed, and this, you know, added to the carnage of modern warfare was this idea of the, you know, instead of a muzzle loader rifle, suddenly you had these semi-automatic repeating cartridge rifles. And then we'll see things like the Gatling gun machine guns develop later. And so in 1861, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as the 16th president. At the same time, Alexander II is emancipated the serfs in Russia with the Emancipation Manifesto. Then on the 12th of April, 1861, General Pierce D. Beauregard demanded that Major Robert Anderson surrender at Fort Sumter in the Charleston, South Carolina harbor. Anderson said 2 days, you know, until his supplies ran out, and Beauregard refused that and ordered his Confederate troops to open fire. They then bombarded the Fort Sumter for 34 hours, and Anderson was forced to surrender. The new Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, said that he had the view that after a state seceded from the Union, federal forts became the property of the state. And so the American Civil War began. And it's very interesting that in the same place that they were setting up, Isaac Long was setting up his, you know, Luciferian Palladium system, and he bringing in a statue of Baphomet into the Charleston harbor, the Charleston area. That was such a stronghold of both, you know, Jewish plantation owners, slave market, you know, rich Jewish people there in Charleston, that was where the first shots were fired that launched this war called the American Civil War. But as we see next week, we're going to see that the actual war was far from anything civil. So I hope you have enjoyed tonight's show on the part one of the run-up to the U.S. Civil War. And I hope everyone has a wonderful evening and a great week. And until next time, I will see you at the rendezvous. Thank you.